Welcome to The Second Half, an oral history project sponsored by the Women's Studies Research Center and by the Journalism Program at Brandeis University. In these oral histories, Brandeis student journalists interview women over 50, from judges to sociologists and from doctors to artists. Though each woman's story is unique, they all show a wealth of wisdom, resilience, and joy in their second half of life. In this episode, Brenna Perlstein interviews Mindy Freed, an applied sociologist by trade who also produces arts and culture events in the Boston area. At an age where many of her peers are retiring, Mindy loves what she does and shows no signs of stopping. Her life story raises some fascinating questions. How do our parents influence the course of our career path and our personal lives? And how can we honor them while also staying true to ourselves?
People don't like talking about decline in general, because what you're talking about is loss and death. In our culture, people don't want to talk about those things. For me, it was one of the hardest things to talk about, and that's why I had to figure out how to do it.
That's Mindy Freed. She's an applied sociologist and the co-principal of a small consulting group in Boston. Among many accomplishments, Mindy is the author of Caring for Red, a memoir about her aging father, an actor and community organizer who Mindy took care of in the last year of his life. The book, much like Mindy's own life story, explores how we can be there for each other and keep our own sense of self in the process.
Do you think caring for your father changed your perspective on aging?
My father inspired me in terms of how he lived his life. He was nearly 98. He was 4 days shy of 98 when he died and was a very engaged, active, older person. You know, at the point where we started caring for him, he was at that point 96 and a half. And he had had a very full multiple careers and different chapters of his life. And at that point, he was in decline. He probably wasn't the best dying person, if that's to be said. He really didn't want to leave this universe. And so I think he had a harder time when he was declining. But certainly, as he lived his life, that was the inspiration for me.
Live life for as long as you can.
And live life fully. One of the things that I learned from him was that as you get older, if you're lucky enough to have a long life, chances are you've lost quite a few friends along the way and family members along the way. And so the key to staying engaged is having younger friends, being involved with things that connects you with people who are doing okay.
It's funny, I have older parents and they always say that because they have a younger daughter, I'm the reason that they have like younger friends because all my friends' parents are not the same age as them. And so they get to have younger friends.
And how is that for you?
It definitely changed a lot of my childhood, and them getting older is definitely something I think about a lot more. I think like when I was younger, it wasn't something I thought about. I didn't really realize that they were different.
Right.
That they're also so much more experienced and like know about life, you know?
Right. Comes in handy.
Yeah. What advice would you give to someone who is preparing to take care of an older family member like your father?
I would say it's important to find a community of people. It's very difficult to navigate the caregiving trajectory. I'd say to be open and have conversations about what the care recipient is going through, what they feel they can handle, and what, you know, what's working for them, what's not, and to be, you know, as loving and caring as you can, but also real. Oftentimes, caregivers from a family, siblings, don't get along in the process. And so it's important for siblings to have honest conversations about how they can coordinate care, what they feel they can and can't do, to engage the parent in the process of thinking about where they might want to be. And, you know, don't just pop it on them like, oh, this is where you're going.
Right. I'm sure it's a very complicated process.
It shouldn't be, but it really is. There's so many factors.
Do you think it's something people don't really talk about because there's, I don't know, any feeling of shame there? Do you think it's like a taboo subject?
So as my dad was going, you know, declining, I got a call from Karen Hansen, who asked if I would come back to Brandeis and teach a course on aging. When you teach something, you are learning something. And what I discovered was that like the one thread that ran through every single person in that class was that they had grandparents that they loved. After I'd taught the class for about a month, my dad died. had to think about, you know, am I going to walk into this class? You know, am I going to just be a puddle of tears and can I actually teach? But I decided that I would do it. So I came in and I said, well, my dad just died. And then I opened this conversation about grief and loss. And it was like, oh, everybody's talking about this stuff. And this is a kind of a taboo topic. And here we are talking about people we have all lost. And a lot of them have that experience. So we're afraid of losing a parent, afraid of losing a grandparent. And taboo in the sense, it's hard to look at our own mortality. You know, after I wrote Caring for Red, I spent about a year and a half touring the country. And on some level, I kind of got tired of telling my own story. But what I realized was that my story was resonating with so many people that I spoke with. The experience of caregiving is an isolating experience. It's sort of like they're recreating the wheel. They don't know what other people have gone through. They're struggling to navigate complicated systems. And that kind of inspired me to try and find a way to do something that was more universal.
In late 2019, Mindy created The Shape of Care, a podcast series that examines the world of caregiving.
My daughter, who's now in her 30s, was a huge podcast fan. So she kind of turned me on to a few podcasts like Two Dope Queens and This American Life. And I started thinking about whether maybe I could learn how to podcast. You know, as a sociologist, I've been trained in interviewing techniques and I've done a ton of interviews over the years. So it's sort of taking that skill and adapting it to a podcast environment. So there are a lot of learning curves in there, a lot of things that I did not know how to do. But my goal was to create a virtual community of people who would hear stories that they could resonate with, learn about sort of the ups and downs and feel a sense of direction for caregiving and maybe not feel quite so alone.
What was it like entering this like podcast world as an older person?
That's a good question. I don't know. I think that I kind of feel, and this is sort of how I felt when I was teaching as well, that I'm all the ages that I've been. And so I can relate to people at different stages of the life cycle. I don't feel like, you know, oh, you're 20 and therefore I can't connect with you. I feel like we probably have a lot to connect around. You know, I'd say in the context of this podcasting world, I was a learner and I felt very welcomed into that world. You know, I feel proud of the progress I made. It was not easy. It's hard to do a podcast the kind I was trying to do.
One of Mindy's greatest sources of pride is the mentor role she has developed with younger people in her life. Mindy's had her fair share of challenging life experiences, and she believes that this makes it easier for her to connect with anyone, no matter what stage of life they're in.
I have a lot of connections with younger people. So one of the roles that I've played is, well, I co-created a nonprofit called Hoopla Productions, which produces music and arts events that are intended to pull people together across the divides of race, class, culture, and immigrant status. And that work as a producer has brought me into touch with people of all ages and backgrounds. I'm clearly the older person in the room, but I don't relate to people as an older person. I relate around our shared love of the arts. So I don't know, I guess in some ways I followed my father's footsteps in the sense that I bring myself into settings in which age is not a factor. At the banquet where there's lots of dancing, I'm out there on the dance floor. I still love to dance. I'm very, you know, active. What I notice is that some of the older people who are my kind of quasi contemporaries are kind of sitting and watching and enjoying, but don't engage quite as much. But that, you know, I feel like I can kind of play in both worlds, you know, in mentoring students, having fun, as well as my other work where I'm just playing a producer role.
You've done a lot. That's very cool.
Well, I used to say that to my father all the time, and he'd say, I've lived a long time.
When you say you've been through a lot and you've had experiences that help you connect, what do you mean by that?
Well, I'd say like on a personal level, like I'm super tight with my daughter. Okay. You know, I mean, my daughter is actually now engaged. It's been fantastic kind of watching her go through whatever relationship stuff she has. I can relate to the stages of relationship development, finding yourself in the context of work, you know, problem solving. There's other things that I, you know, which are not me. I don't drink at all. And some of the younger people I know love having cocktails. And like my mom was an alcoholic, so it just kind of triggers me, you know, but I know when I should not say anything. you know, try not to be judgmental or, I don't know. I mean, I, you know, when you say I've gone through a lot of stages in life, I've had many different careers and I've learned a lot through each one of them. I've had many different relationships over the years, and I now have been in a stable relationship for over 30 years. And so, you know, there are things that you learn when you go through all that crap, some of which is helpful to other people.
When did you first notice that she was alcoholic?
So there are a lot of ways that people can act as an alcoholic, and some people are really better at covering it up than others. And I think she was really good at that. So there were sort of two things that happened that I'll mention that were sort of eye-opening. One is that I knew that she was drinking earlier in the day. But what I noticed at one point, like she would say, oh, I'm only having a shot. And then when I looked at her shot glass, I realized that it was actually four shots. So if she was having two shots, that was eight shots. Or she was having three shots, you know, et cetera, do the math. It, you know, was pretty appalling and scary. So I just realized how much she was consuming. And the other thing is that, you know, growing up, I had another mother, quote unquote, my best friend's mom, who played a surrogate mom role to me. When I was in my 20s, she said to me something about my mother being an absent mother. And it took me a while to, I really had to process that because I didn't see her as absent. But after being a mother myself, becoming a mother myself, and how engaged I am, it's sort of like nothing like what my mother did with me. And my surrogate mom said she was kind of spaced out. And I think that was the alcohol. You know, we grow up in households where we think it's all normal until we see something else. So I never really questioned. I just knew that I had a kind of a quiet household and I didn't get a lot of attention. You know, not to say that she was also really creative and she did find projects, I think I mentioned, that where she engaged me and friends in her artistic things. When she was younger and I was younger, she wrote songs and she did this big project about animals and she wrote all these songs about, you know, a turtle and a kitten and a worm. I mean, there were all these, and I could sing you all these songs, but I won't. And she put together a chorus with me and my friend, Gail, hired a professional singer and got a studio. And my father, he wrote and did all the narration. He was an actor. And so we had this sort of family project. My dad would tell the story about it, and then, you know, the turtle. And then I had a solo for my little kitty, which I was, you know, and that was really a great project. It just, you know, probably, I think truly the only creative project in which we all were involved.
What would you want to say either to your younger self or these people that you're close with now?
What would I say to my younger self would be like, stop worrying so much. Like life doesn't have to be lived in a day, that you've got time and different chapters of your life to explore different parts of yourself. And I've had a lot of crappy jobs, you know, done things that have made me unhappy. And I'm grateful for those jobs and those experiences because I learned what I didn't want to do. So, I mean, I had crappy jobs, you know, as a waitress or, you know, that sort of thing. But I think what I'm going to focus on is a crappy job that I had running a research project. Somebody was hired who came in with a lot of energy and ambition. The project that I was running, she took a look at it and she saw that the budget was really a problem. I wasn't in charge of the budget. The person that I co-did it with was in charge of the budget. Anyway, when this new person came on board and discovered that the budget was awry, somehow, well, she assumed that it was me who had made the mistakes and he didn't correct her. And so there was like an entire month in which I was really in the hole because she felt that I had totally messed up. And in fact, it was him. And it was sort of deceit by through silence in a way in which he allowed her to think, you know, he charmed her and he allowed her to think that I was the mess up. It was probably the most emotionally traumatic of the crappy jobs just because I had worked really hard and felt that I was doing a good job. And all of a sudden I was being blamed for this major administrative problem. Spent a month of just having trouble breathing. And I remember going swimming a lot. When I was in the pool, it was kind of the only time that I felt like I was really, truly breathing. I was so anxious. And my father, who had been a labor organizer, was really smart about work stuff, was an amazing advisor through this period, because he just said, just stay focused on the integrity of your work. And ultimately, I guess the message was, the truth will come out. And he was right. A month later, when she kind of figured out who was doing what and what was what, she came to me, this is the boss, and said, she didn't apologize, but she said, I realize that it wasn't you. I just let out this sort of great sigh of relief that I wasn't being blamed. But in that period of time, that month, it really did taint the professional relationships I had.
How did that feel to have her come to this realization?
I felt relieved that I was seen for what I had actually accomplished and produced. And it was a giant lesson learned, because I think my bad was that I wasn't more aggressive in asking this person, this guy, to account to me what he was and wasn't doing. Part of the dynamic was that he hired me, and then I was an equal to him. I wasn't actually supervising him. But when we discovered what was going on, I asked to be his supervisor and was given that power. So I went from feeling pretty powerless to feeling powerful. And it was something that I will probably always take with me, that I learned that even if you're not in a position of power, you need to understand the full picture of what you're working on, and just assert yourself. And I have now been doing that. That was a while ago, and it influenced how I applied that approach to many, many other situations.
Do you have any regrets about choices you've made?
I don't. There are things that I've learned that have been really hard. I've had difficult conversations. I've felt like I've made mistakes that I feel bad about, but that I've learned from and have gotten better at. When we first started Hoopla Productions, we're all about diversity, with it like really bringing people together, using the arts as this vehicle. In a conversation I had with a woman of color who wanted to have like a separate space for African-American artists, and I had a reaction to that. We're not creating separate spaces. I feel like I was coming from a place that made sense given what we were about. The way I responded was not respectful. She was offended. It kind of had ramifications over time. And so, you know, I kind of did my best to try and let her know my intent wasn't to be offensive or to hurt her or whatever. But I think that people of color in this country have experienced so much pain and suffering that I could see where, in the context of her feeling safe with me, saying something would kind of trigger her. And it was a real eye opener. You know, I really struggled with how to be a better ally. You know, I think as a woman, as a Jewish woman, as a feminist, especially as somebody who went through the second wave of the women's movement, where we were trying to find our voice and raise our consciousness and, you know, speak out and all that, we went through a lot to find our voices. So in working with people from different backgrounds, sometimes you have to not be the loudest voice in the room, and that there's power in that as well.
How do you think about your future, both professionally and personally?
Probably the majority of people my age consider themselves retired. You know, Social Security kicks in at 70, and so there is an income. Even if I didn't work for pay, I have some income. And so it kind of takes the pressure off of making the kind of money that I always felt I needed to make. I'm working now with Our Bodies Ourselves Today, which is now a fully online resource. It's amazing. And it's this compilation of curated resources on all these issues. My daughter has said, like, when are you going to slow down? I don't feel stressed out. I think that's the key. There are things that I wish I had a little bit more time to do. Like, I play piano and I haven't done that in a little bit. My Spanish is rusty. I'm trying to fix it. I want to live a life of purpose. I want to do things that make a difference. I want to be involved in the kinds of things that give me juice, that I have passion for. But I don't imagine that I'm going to be somebody who's going to be making scrapbooks for the last 20 years of my life. Not to put down scrapbooks. Scrapbooks are cool, but that's not where my energy goes.
Mindy's professional and personal life have taken her in many different directions, and as she gets older, she's showing no signs of stopping. The most valuable lesson I learned from Mindy during our conversation is that you can be an excellent mentor and caregiver while still having fun. And actually, it's crucial to your success. Have fun and live a good life. There's no age limit on that.
Thank you for listening. This project is affiliated with The Second Half, a book by photojournalist Ellen Warner and published by the Brandeis University Press in 2022. Our student journalist team includes Lauren Williams, Brenna Perlstein, and Jillian Brasovsky. Our show music is written and produced by Bethel Adakobi. Our project manager is myself, Claire Ogden, and our consulting producers are Neil Swidey and Iris Adler. We would like to include a special thank you to Stephanie Lawrence, Harleen Singh, and Kristen Mullen, the WSRC team. Thanks for tuning in, and see you next time.